Right, ladies and gentlemen, we don't want to get away too late, so we better make a start in the second half. So I know that there are a couple of people away today who wanted to talk about their own experiences of death and dying. And unfortunately, they're not here, but I'm sure we'll all have our own experiences. I'd just like to mention something that I remember. I've probably sat and watched probably about three people die, I think. But I remember my ancient grandmother, who died at the age of 96, who'd had a very colorful life. She'd lived in Alexandria between the wars. The family at that time were very rich. They had a Rolls Royce and the big house. And when they had a party, it was never less than about 300 people. It was that kind of a lifestyle. And obviously, there was the war, and they lost everything, and they came to England. And so she had quite a colorful life, really. But anyhow, what I remember was her body lying in the hospital morgue on, as I remember it, a kind of marble slab. And she had been a very beautiful woman, but this was a lady of 96, and it wasn't such a beautiful sight at 96. Anyhow, I went over to her, and I just observed her for a few moments, and then I spontaneously went up to her and kissed her forehead. My old granny, yeah? And I got a real shock, because when I kissed her forehead, it was like kissing the marble that she was lying on. There was nothing there. 96 years, goodness knows what had gone on in that life. And there was absolutely nothing. Peter, would you like to take the second half? Thank you.
Well, that was absolutely fantastic, wasn't it? I hope you all enjoyed it. Amazing, wonderful description of the opening of the heart and of love. And I'd just like to take up Philip's point there. What he said about kissing his grandmother and the fact it was like marble. If you talk to people whose relatives have died, some of you will tell us stories about this, there comes a point after they've died when they're still there in the room with you, in the body. Very clear. And then at a certain moment, the body empties and you're just left with just this marble slab, really, which is there. And it's very important to know this, because if the body is taken away too soon, then the relatives don't have the pleasure, because it is a pleasure, actually, I think not so much pleasure, a comfort of knowing that the person who was in the body has gone, and it's very clear. And it probably something in the order of about 2 hours to 10 hours is the range that I've come across. So the departure from the body is important. And of course people aren't told about it. And so when the person has died and they come back and they just see this empty case in front of them, it is a shock, as Philip said. But you can prepare people for this. So how many of you have sat with a dying person? Almost all of you, which it should be. So, well, let's home in on it more precisely. How many of you sat with a person as they died? Yes, okay, that's fewer of you. Would any of you like to describe what it is like to be with a dying person, with a person who is actually dying?
I lost my husband 3 years ago. I wasn't there when he died. I also lost one of my sisters, and I was there until very shortly before she died. And one of the things I noticed, and we talked about a lot afterwards, was that we thought she had a very good death because we were all around her the whole time. She died very suddenly. She knew that she had an illness which was going to take her very quickly. And for someone who I probably would never have considered particularly spiritual, she acquired a spirituality during that time, and she actually was comforting us rather than we comforting her. And as the days went by, she took about 10 days to leave us. There was a gradual softening of her, and she had been in an enormous pain. And as the days went by, perhaps also due to the various medicines she was given, the lines left her face, and she actually became a young woman again. And I found that incredibly moving. And similarly, with my husband, although I wasn't there, the day that he died, I was in France, and he was in the north of England rehearsing for an opera. He was an opera singer. And that morning, which was a beautiful morning, I was out looking out over the countryside and over the stream, and a kingfisher flew past me, which was incredibly moving. And I phoned my husband immediately, who was on the train up to Leeds, and told him. And he was very excited, and because it was something that meant a lot to us. And he went into rehearsal, and everything was absolutely fine. And later in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock, the director of the opera phoned and asked where I was. And I immediately said, "Why, is Richard dead?" I had no reason to say this because we'd talked about everything. And he died very, very suddenly, which was a wonderful way for him to die. And I realize that now. And when I went up immediately to Leeds to see him with my son, we went to the morgue, and he was lying there. It was incredibly emotional. But actually, when I saw him, it was no longer my beloved husband. It was, as Philip said, it was someone of marble, and I knew he wasn't there. And my son said immediately, "Well, it's Papa, but it's not Papa because his essence has gone." And that was precisely it.
Yes, that's, thank you very much. It's exactly right. Who else? Thank you.
Thank you. So I have two stories. First, concerning my father, who died 7 years ago, and I spent probably about most of the last 10 days of his life with him, sitting by his bed, and we had some conversations. And he went into kind of comatose state, I suppose. He lay there, and every day the doctor came and couldn't believe that he was still holding on because he hadn't eaten or drunk anything. And he went about 7 more days without any fluid at all. And in the night we sat around, my mother, my sister, and I, and just watched his chest just eventually just stop. And I also related to this experience of how young he looked. He was 94, and I just exclaimed, I actually said out loud, "He looked so young." Something happened in his face in that moment of death. Second story is very current for me. It's very raw. But it will be good for me to speak it out loud. I came here to the session, the second session, 4 weeks ago. And the following Thursday, while you were here, I was on a train down to Devon because my mother had been admitted to hospital and she was having an emergency operation. While I was on the train, I had a sense that it was too late. There was something just that I felt leaving, just a real sort of sense of despair, really. And I got to the hospital, and she had died 3 weeks ago tonight, at 9:30, and I went into intensive care, and they wouldn't let me go in straight away. I had to wait for about 15 minutes. So it was about 11 o'clock when I went in, and I sat with her and I held her hand and cried and said some things to her. And what you have just said about this 2 hour to 10 hour period is a huge comfort to me, because I wasn't there at the moment that she medically died. But all I can say is I felt there was still something was leaving her at that stage, and I sat for an hour, really, until the medical team said, look, you know, it's gone midnight, you know, it's time to go, sort of thing. And that was, it was incredibly moving for me to be there at that time, so soon after she died. And I kissed her forehead and left. And then on the day of her funeral last week, I did go to see her body again at the funeral home, and it was a completely different yes. experience. Absolutely. There was nothing there. It was yes. just a corpse.
Yes, yes, absolutely right. There is this very clear transition which occurs. Thank you very much for that story. One of the interesting points about it was the feeling of despair that you felt in the train going down, and the way that visits the relatives get knowledge of the fact that somebody is dying is well described. And it's only because we like to hold ourselves separate and don't see ourselves as being part of a much greater whole that we're surprised by this. But if you have close emotional attachments, then one does know a lot about people at a distance. So I'm sure that that was all part of the process. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
I nursed a patient back in 1972 in a coronary care unit. It was the first death I'd encountered as a young student nurse. Mm-hmm. And I was a very young student nurse, so I didn't take much part in the resuscitation process that was going on. But he had a cardiac arrest, and they were working on him. I was on duty at the time. So I witnessed what was going on and his recovery afterwards. And that evening, I was helping him wash behind the curtains, and he started relating to me his experience when he had been, when they were working on him, because he had actually seen them doing this. Yes. But he'd gone off walking down, where the ward was divided into two. The coronary care unit was within a larger ward, and he'd gone off walking down this ward through the glass partitions. He described walking through them, and he'd gone up to visit and try and talk to some of his friends who he'd known previously before he'd got so confined to bed. And then he said, and he sounded quite surprised to tell me that they didn't seem to be able to see him. This surprised him. And he was wanting to say goodbye and that explain that he where he was in bed and some stories about himself. And this bothered him a bit. But he was very matter-of-fact when he was telling me this. And at the time, I'd never heard this phrase, near-death experience. And I don't know if it was around in 1972. Anyway, we continued discussing this a bit. It was such a long time ago, it's a little bit fuzzy. But I then remember him saying to me, "This is going to happen tomorrow. And this time, nurse, I've decided I'm not coming back." He was a little bit irritated that he'd been brought back. But he did predict this was going to happen again, and this time I'm decided I'm not coming back. And the next day when I went on duty, his bed was empty. He'd had another cardiac arrest, and they hadn't managed to revive him. I've always remembered that. It had quite an effect on me.
Thank you very much. It's a very nice near-death story. It links up with your story, because do you remember how when you went to see your mother, you talked to her for a period of time? And this is most important, because many other traditions, not in our tradition, but in the Tibetan tradition, when consciousness is lost, the people are still there, and they can hear what people say, and then when they finally leave, you've gone through several of the actual death processes, but these occur while you're still in the body and still around. And so what you were saying about this person hearing what was going on is important. And so if you're with the dying, particularly if there's somebody who you are closely emotionally involved with, then it's very important to talk to them and say goodbye to them, because the evidence probably is that they in fact can hear what you're saying and still understand it, although it'll probably be in a different sort of way from what they do otherwise. So the actual death period itself is enormously important. Yes.
If they can actually sense what you're feeling about them as, at a deeper level than what you might actually say to them.
That's certainly true. The question is, can you communicate by feeling at this time? If you take the near-death experience, then what people feel is recognized by other people. In other words, you don't separate into intellect and speech. Yep. You are a whole package.
My own experience of being around somebody at death was, I wasn't actually physically present, but I was very connected at a psychic level. I'd been contemplating something about my father and realized that he was autistic, and that explained so much about the way he was. And I'd got some books on autism, and I can remember sitting down, having just got the books, to read them, thinking, in a few days, when I've read these and thought about them, I'll ring him and talk to him, knowing that this is what he is, and that explains why he is this way. Next morning, I got a phone call to say he'd died. What time? It was precisely when I sat down with the books.
Yes. Yes.
Now, the way I understand it is that my recognition of him enabled him to let go and die. The doctor who looked at his body said, chronic heart failure, could have died any time in the last 10 years. And he waited till the moment I understood him for what he was and did something about it. And then he just left.
Yes, I like that very much, because The facts are that at the time of death, then you communicate, not everybody, but a certain number, certainly it's around 30% of people, will communicate with somebody, a relative who's very close, or somebody they're very close to, and give them a message of some sort. Mm. So your linkage makes very good sense.
Yep. Actually, after he had died, I meditated with him. It was, and I had several conversations, particularly during the next 40 days after he died. And it was really interesting talking to him.
Yes. There's been a recent study on after-death communication and what people who are recently bereaved sense. And the communication between the dead person and the person who, the relative who's left, or the loved one who's left, is really quite high. And it takes all sorts of forms. It takes speaking. It takes on touching and feeling, and it takes on a sense of smell as well. So all these senses can be activated in the period after the person has died. Okay, anybody else?
Could I relate one other experience which is quite relevant to somebody being sensing somebody at the time of death? I was meditating on somebody who I knew who was heading towards dying. She wasn't very far off it, and then somebody, I just had something burst into my contemplation, and I saw something like an arrangement of flowers. It wasn't actually, it was some curls of light, some of them red, some of them green, and I immediately thought of somebody who I knew, and later on I found out that that was exactly when she died.
Yes. And again, it doesn't really surprise me, because the actual dying process, if you look at what's going on around, a lot of the normal barriers we have are broken down. Thank you. Yes.
There's a lady I knew, and I used to study German at school. We went on an exchange visit, and I stayed with a family in Hamburg. And the mother was a very kind person, and I really liked her. And I hadn't seen her for years. Then one night I got this very vivid dream. She was slowly floating through a tunnel towards a beautiful light. And the next day I got a telephone call to say she'd died.
Yes. Yes, thank you. And again, what we're looking at, what we've been looking at today is, of course, going from death into life. And the near-death experience is a wonderful example of going through death into life. And the data which I was telling you about in our first session, I think, was how the current evidence is now pointing to transcendent states in the dying being very common. So there they in fact do exactly that. The death process is a process of going through into life. So anybody else got a story they'd like to tell us about what happens when somebody has died?
Just picking up on what you said about when people are close, they get messages. I was speaking to my auntie last week, who's 96, and she was telling me about her first husband. And this was about 1938-39. And she said, as soon as he was called up in the war, she knew she had to marry him because it would be his last chance to get married. But anyway, they had 3 years together. And she said, and then he went off abroad. And we both knew that was it. I wouldn't see him again. And I said, Auntie, how did you know? And she just said, God.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's very interesting that there's no doubt that some people do get warnings about other people when they're going to die. And there's a very small literature on that, but there is a definite one. Yes, it's our insistence, isn't it, that we're all separate, when in fact the evidence is the other way. Anybody else like to say something? Thank you.
Yes, I'm not very good with death. I think that's why I'm here. But thinking about my father's illness and when I was with him, certainly during the earlier stages where he could still communicate, the cancer was affecting his voice very much. It turned into a whisper, and he was trying to explain something to me, and he said, "Give me a bit of paper. You know, this is very important." So I got a piece of paper, and he's trying to write very shaky hand. I don't know what to do. And it was just that. And this was, my father was a great man. He was a professor of history who ended up at Balliol College and went as far as he possibly could. He'd obviously learned how to live, but he didn't know how to do death. And I thought to myself, I don't want to be like that. But later on, I'm afraid things got a bit more negative. Later on, it was very, very difficult for me for various reasons. I think I even almost had some kind of breakdown during this period, trying to look after him when he was going into the coma, and every day it just seemed to go on and on and on. And there was one morning that I got there, and I was in a terrible state, and my father was... He was resting, he didn't need anything, so we went downstairs, myself and his longest school friend, Patrick. And I was coming out with this terrible speech, terrible diatribe about how, you know, this proves it, everything's rubbish. The whole universe is rubbish. Nobody should be born. It's complete rubbish. Nobody should live. You know, I was really going for it. And suddenly there was this loud bang in the room next door. And Patrick went to look, and what had happened was, I have to explain, there were two sheets of glass, one resting on the other, that were to replace a broken panel upstairs. And these were resting on the settee. And one had not fallen, slid down to the ground and broken. It had actually exploded, just at the point that I was, you know, rubbishing the whole universe and everything. The thing exploded. It was shatterproof glass. There were these fragments all over the floor. And Patrick said, "Oh, no, why did that happen?" And I said to him, "It seems that somebody disagreed with something I was saying." He says, "Hard not to come to that conclusion."
Yes. It's a very nice point you're making, and it's one which we tend to miss because we're so in our heads and not actually looking at what's happening around us. And I think probably many of us have got stories like this. One of my favorite ones was a rather distant relative who had come back from Thailand, and he'd got a lot of Tibetan paintings with him. And he was saying how pleased he was he'd got these paintings. But, of course, they didn't mean anything, but he'd be able to sell them for a lot. He was saying that the Dalai Lama was rubbish, and our ceiling collapsed and showered him with bits of mortar. He wasn't hurt, but, it's amazing synchronicity. And your story of the glass pane breaking is exactly that. Now, you weren't here, but we had a talk from a Chinese guy who was pointing out that, in fact, synchronicity is really what it's all about, listening and noting to what's going on. And he told the story, and he got the video of it, so it was obviously true. He was talking to this guy in America who is a total materialist, but yet a questioning materialist, which is just fine. And he was saying to this Chinese guy, "Well, look, there is just no evidence that there is such a thing as God, is there?" And this Chinese guy was saying, well, yes, but you don't listen properly to what's going on. He says, well, you just give me some proof that there's such a thing as God. And so he said, well, just why don't you just listen to what's going on? And at that moment, the church bells rang out. Again, nice piece of synchronicity. And those of you who know you're Jung will find that synchronistic events occurred to Jung frequently, and particularly when he was with Freud. So, yes, we are linked together. And when you come to death and dying, you have certain roles to play. First of all, when you're dying, but secondly, as a relative. And that is to help people let go. And there is nothing worse than having a whole lot of relatives who are determined to keep the people there, rather than to let them go. And one of the nicest hospices I've been to was run by two amazing women in Rotterdam, a lovely hospice, where in fact the dying were given really as much attention as they needed. And one of the things that she always said, and it became perfectly apparent that it's true, is that dying is a very sacred time. You do not want to do it if you can avoid it. You don't want to do it in hospital, because hospitals aren't set up to care for the dying. They're set up to care for those who are well. And you want to be quiet, and you want to be loving, and you want to be there to assist the person who's actually dying. That's the mental set you need. You don't actually have to say anything. Holding a hand, just touching somebody, is, as you know very well, is all that's required. And mentally, of course, you want to love them and then let them go. And you also have to recognize that not everybody will want to die when you're there. And so you want to give them the opportunity to die when you're not there, and you're not to be resentful of it. You don't want to hold them back by thinking, wait until I come back with my coffee. I mean, you obviously don't say that, but it's what you're thinking. So you give the dying person a lot of space, a lot of room, and talking to them afterwards is terribly important, because, as I say in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, consciousness continues for some time after the heart has stopped and breathing has stopped. So it's a reverential moment, and if you can stay out of hospital, do. How many of you have written a living will about what you want to happen? Do you remember, this was a question I asked you right at the beginning. Great. Okay, well, make sure that you've all done this, and there you can make a decision as to what you want to happen when it's quite clear you're going to die. So if you want to die at home, put it in your living wills. So that's very important. Yeah.
If you can comment on the fact that two people said when they saw a person after they'd died, they looked much younger. And it's as if we consciously hang on to our wrinkles.
It's absolutely right. There was a German photographer, I don't know if any of you have seen it, who have taken pictures of people just as they've died or just after they've died, and transfiguration occurs. In many of them, they look absolutely transcendent. In other words, you remember the study which I quoted to you from Switzerland, in which over 60%, but it was probably higher, in fact, people had transcendent experiences as they died. So it was a sort of preparation for what was going on. And with this, at the time of death, transfiguration occurs. And we've got a lot of lovely stories about, first of all, light and love leaving the person at the time of death. Now, if there'd been a video camera there, this is my scientific side, thinking, would they have seen it? The answer is no. because not everybody sees it. You can have two or three people in the room, and they don't see the light, and they don't see this wonderful emanation from the person as they died. So I think it's a sensitivity on the part of the individual as to what they see, because obviously if you're consumed with grief, then you won't see these things. But if you're there with a nice, quiet mind and a loving mind, then it's likely that you may do. So transfiguration at the time of death is very important. And those lovely stories which show the way that the lines relax and you get the transfiguration of the person are absolutely correct.
What happens if a person dies a violent and immediate death, like a car accident or a heart attack, as was the case with my husband?
The model which I use for that, and I think probably is the correct model, well, I would think it, otherwise I wouldn't use it. it's the near-death experience, and when the heart stops and you lose consciousness, and then there are certain phases. The heart stops. You may not know that your heart has stopped. What you feel is probably nothing very much, and then a huge sense of peace and warmth comes over you, and a feeling of love. And then there's the tunnel experience. Don't take it as a literal tunnel, because it's not. It's a moving towards. It's a relative blackness in comparison to the light that you see in front of you. It's got those qualities to it. Some people describe it as the light reflecting off something. In other words, that would give a tunnel shape. Other people just call it a movement towards. And so you move towards the light. And the light, of course, is overwhelming and loving and caring. And then you move into the light, and then you can have a conversation with the light. And the light will... you will probably be asking questions of the light. Am I dead? Am I here? I mean, why am I here? What's going on? But the impression you get from those who've had the experience that the love is so intense that it's okay. It doesn't matter. And you're no longer afraid. And then it depends totally on the person, which... in a way, I think is correct. Those people who go the furthest are those who are able to give up most in the process. And I had one air traffic controller who found himself being asked questions. And what he found was that he knew the answer to all the questions. But if you went into it with him, it was quite clear that he was, in fact, letting go of his attachments. He came to a point when he just became pure energy. And then he moved towards the universal, more into the light, diffused with the light. And it was then that he decided that he had to come back, and he was allowed to come back. So it's... As a model of what happens, nobody, in fact, is left with nowhere to go, and without a process of some sort. It seems certainly all those people who have come back have had a process of some type, and it tends to be along those sorts of lines. So car accidents, okay. But it's hard on the relatives. It's much easier on the relatives if you have a more drawn-out death, because then you can come to terms with it.
Second hand, but I had a chat with a woman who had worked for some time as a nurse in a hospice, and she said that after the person died, she really enjoyed, if she found something deeply sacred in spending time in the room with the person and being present with the energy. And she found it really joyful and uplifting and very transcendent. It was something she found she needed to do whenever somebody she'd been caring for died.
Yes, yes. Yes, thank you for that. And in fact, I did my medical training at St. Thomas's, and the Nightingale philosophy for people when they died was really a very loving one. It was to treat them with care and compassion and not to say anything at all negative in their presence just after they died. Is that what you were taught too?
I think it is disappearing a little bit. there's a lot of reverence around the whole. There used to be a lot of reverence around the whole process, but I have seen it diluting. I just wanted to mention something. I think this is in the Tibetan Book of the Dead and Dying. Is the position that I've noticed if somebody is dying or close to death, they adopt a particular position. I remember noticing this when my father-in-law was dying. He began to return to a kind of fetal position, and which I think is helps the process of letting go. And I noticed we had the nurses all trailed in at this particular time and said we're going to make him more comfortable. We left the room, came back in again, and there he was sitting bolt upright, very well supported to help his breathing. And of course his breathing became much more laboured, and he became more agitated, and it was a long time before he slid back into that nice relaxed position again. And I felt that had got in the way of this letting go.
And that's an enormously interesting comment, because in this hospice in Rotterdam that I was talking to you about, where the people are given a lot of space, they were saying that some people would like to die naked. In other words, they take everything off. They take all their jewelry off. They take all their clothes off. It's really, I think, symbolic of leaving everything behind, of moving on, letting go of your attachments. But of course, it's just the physical manifestation of that.
I have occasionally heard that there are people who have near-death experiences which, rather than being beautiful and going to the light and peaceful and loving, they have experiences which are frightening and horrible. Can you elaborate on that?
Yep. I found this enormously interesting. And you remember what our database was? It was 2,000 letters which we got in response to the first BBC, actually was the second one, story on near-death experiences. And 4% of people who had near-death experiences had negative ones. And you come into an interesting zone. There are two ways of looking at this. One of the most frightening ones that the person described was, in fact, being in hell with the flames of hell licking up and burning her, and also being hit with a pitchfork by devils who would come and thrust it into her.
It sounds like a confirmation of the stories that people tell, particularly in some branches of Christianity, of the fires of hell awaiting people who are sinners.
Yes, but as she became more conscious, she became aware that the flames of hell were, in fact, the heating blanket that she was lying on in intensive care, and that the devils were, in fact, the nurses with their syringes and so on when they were doing their nursing procedures. And what was quite clear to me was that she had, in fact, a paranoid psychosis, an intensive care psychosis. And so I think that when you get people who have very negative experiences, then one needs to look at them carefully to see if you haven't got another explanation for the mental states. But on the other hand, if you take Kant's, like Ibn Alexander's, have you all read it, Proof of Heaven? Neurosurgeon who had a near-death experience. He describes what other people describe, but does it very well. He describes layers of his consciousness, and the base layers of his consciousness are, in fact, heavy. twisted, tubular structures through which he has to try and get. And he's always helped through these, in fact, by some, either the fact that he's going to the light or the fact that he's doing something else. Somebody has come to help him. So he it seems as if that he, in fact, is going through layers of his own psyche and divesting himself of it and then going on up. So you've got the two arguments. One is that it's in terms of one's own psyche that you are going through, and it's part of the letting go process. And the other one is that it is, in fact, some other mental diagnosis, like an intensive care psychosis.
Are you saying that this is a process, like if one has extreme traumas in childhood, then these traumas are relegated to the unconscious or the subconscious or whatever we call it. So when the dying experience arises, does one have to go through, does one have to clear the subconscious material, and this arouses these dreadful, because there's a man called Stanislav Grof, who did a lot of experiments with LSD, and these experiences you described of terrible fires and terrible tortures and stuff were all a clearing of the subconscious.
Yes, there's a very nice book going to come out. It's not been published yet, but I've seen a pre-publication copy by the leader of the Medici Quartet, Paul Robertson. And he, of course, had an aortic aneurysm which burst. But fortunately, he was on the table and they saved his life. And he describes the death process absolutely excellently. And then he describes his coming back to life again. It's a book which is well worth reading, where he, in fact, goes through exactly what you're talking about. It's the recognition that he has to clear a whole lot of stuff within him which relates to his childhood, to the way that he's behaved and so on, things like that. So, yes, I think that's there as well. Yes, I like that. Did you all hear that? Deal with your baggage before you die, so you don't have to deal with this.
I did read a story in one of the books on Tibetan Buddhism, was a very senior lama who was traveling with one of his longtime disciples. And quite suddenly, the disciple just evacuated his body. He just died. It took only a handful of minutes. And there was just such trust. He was just so ready. He had no baggage. He just was able simply, it was time, okay, gone, exit. Because he had no baggage to let go of. Yes. And on the other hand, I could describe a relative of mine who had reached the point of death. And for 18 months, he couldn't let go of his body. He just stayed there right on the point of death, and he couldn't die. He wasn't able to let go. And that was hell for not only for him, but for everybody caring for him, because he had so much baggage that he couldn't let go of.
Yes. It's interesting. We were talking a little bit in the interval about going to sleep and what it's like going to sleep and what you do going to sleep. And in a sense, there is a whole mechanism there which will kick in at the appropriate time as you die. And I, from my experience of it, and listening to people's stories, etc., it seems to me that it's well looked after if you will let it be. And this means not having wailing relatives keeping you back, and also having quietness and peace in which to die. So home deaths with a Macmillan nurse in this country is okay. And they'll look after you. But the other half of this, and we don't have time for it, but we'll have more time for it, and some of the other ones, is in fact going from life, going from death to life. And your homework, which none of you ever do.
Homework. No matter what group he's with, he gives them homework.
One of these days I'll examine you on it. Is to see how many times you in fact are dead and go to life. And this is when you come out of your head into the moment and you remember how precious the moment is for you. And those people who die, or given the final diagnosis, are absolutely clear about this. Suddenly, the whole world is brightened because they've only got a few more moments left. I mean, maybe a year or whatever it is, but that's a few moments. And what do? You give up your attachments. It's that lovely bit that Philip read. And so you all want to practice this like mad. And so I want some good stories next time of how you found yourself dead and then became alive. Okay, and I think we should all thank James very much for his
Peter,
really
can I...
wonderful talk. And that's what it's like, it's coming alive.
Peter, can I just mention, because this course is called The Art and Science of Dying, and it also says underneath, A Journey into the Light. I don't know if you remember the advertising. But I remember I had a philosophy student many years ago who was vivacious, outgoing. She couldn't ever stop talking. Anyhow, she got a brain tumor, and the brain tumor meant that she lost her ability to speak. And I used to visit her at home from time to time. And I can't tell you the amount, especially on a couple of visits, I walked into her room, and it was like walking into an extraordinary radiance. It was as if the sun was literally in the room. And I'd sit with her, hold her hands, we'd say absolutely nothing. And it was as if the light grew and grew and grew. It was an extraordinary lesson in this kind of purification, which was the... She died probably a couple of days after, I think, the last time I met her. But there's a kind of purification in all this, and I think that's the sacredness of it. And the other example, if I give very quickly, is a musician friend of mine who suddenly rang me out of the blue. I knew that she'd had cancer and was seriously ill. And she suddenly rang me, and I can't even remember what we were talking about. But what was extraordinary was that she was totally ready to die. She was totally at peace, she said to me. And literally, I could feel the light coming down the telephone. I can only describe it like that. It was the most extraordinary experience. It was like the same radiance. And it was the kind of essence of it was this acceptance that she was totally at peace with this whole process that was going on. So I think there's a lesson in that for us. So it's all about the light, not the dark. That's the message of this course, I hope. So next week, you can look forward to When Death Began, which was when? The Garden of Eden, exactly. So I look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, James. Thank you, Matt, who's not here. Thank you, all of you. Cheers.
Thanks very much.